welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hi, this is Veronica Monet, your host for the Shame Free Zone. We are live. We're live here on BBS Radio, and we're live on Facebook. If you're not my friend yet, you better hurry up. I'm getting very close to the Facebook limit. Hopefully, if you're already on my page, you have tuned in, and I've got the link. I've got the call-in numbers up there. I'd like to get the show going here before you call in, but if you give us about 5 or 10 minutes, you're welcome to call in, make your own contribution to the Shame Free Zone, and that toll-free number is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I already have a caller on the line standing by. His name is Eric, and he is in Seattle, Washington. Eric, welcome to the Shame Free Zone. What can I do for you tonight?
Veronica, thank you. I'm pretty excited to be able to pick your brains here for a while.
Go for it.
So sacred sex, maybe, I mean, you and I have talked a little bit about it, but that leaves the listeners kind of behind. So could you just give me a quick once-over of what is sacred sex?
Well, okay. Here's my short answer is all sex is sacred. But obviously there are some things we mistakenly label sex, which I don't really think qualify. But it's kind of like, you know, we say life is sacred. I think that that sex has sacredness in it. That's one of the reasons that it's such a charged topic, why people are so terrified and afraid of it.
Well, yeah.
Because it carries in it a great deal of our core spirituality. And the reason that I believe that is true is because for probably most of us, if not all of us, our first sexual experiences actually start in the womb before we're ever born. So that means that, you know, most of us probably had our first orgasms before we ever had a breath of air, we ever had a bite of food, we ever had a sip of mother's milk. You know, obviously we weren't thinking about sex with another human being, we weren't thinking about, you know, eroticism or erotic art or pornography or, you know, anything like that, which kind of suggests to me that that first orgasm was probably a very, very spiritual one and more about being connected to the universe and or God or goddess, you know, whatever concept you may have for spirituality. So I think that's where we get our start, and then from there, of course, it all goes downhill.
Oh, no.
No, but I mean, you know, it's like everything else. You know, we're born with an ability to live in the moment, but as adults, we're always trying to learn how to get back to that. Most of us are born knowing how to breathe, but after, you know, we spend a certain amount of time getting socialized in the educational system and then our jobs and whatnot, we have to go back and learn how to do conscious breathing. So there's always this journey back to try to connect with, you know, our core. So that's my long-winded, vague answer, but I'm thinking you probably wanted something more specific.
Well, you said that some sex isn't sacred and some is. So what makes it sacred for you?
I think there are some things we mistakenly label as sex.
Oh, that's what you said, right?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to, I guess, my training as a feminist, which was that, you know, we didn't call rape sex. Now, you go back far enough historically, and people did consider rape to be sex. As a matter of fact, this was oftentimes the only way that married people had sex, was by husbands raping their wives. But at some point, you know, we decided that this was actually a form of violence and that we were no longer going to call it sex.
We the feminists.
I think we the culture, actually.
Okay.
I don't think it was just feminists. I think at some point people started realizing this was a brutal and cruel thing to do to another human being.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So, whether they considered themselves feminist or not, but I would imagine the feminist movement, you know, spearheaded that. Some people would say that. Actually, if you want to know the truth, there's a book out there right now that purports that it was mostly the prostitutes who started really raising people's awareness around rape. Another conversation for another time, though.
Okay.
So whoever decided that, most of us got on board for it at some point, just as most of us got on board for the whole idea that slavery is wrong. But there are still some things out there that I think are very closely linked to violence that we're still calling sex. And I think any time that you are abusive and cruel to another human being or even to yourself, that you know, you're not really engaging in sex. Now, for some people, they're going to automatically think that we're maybe talking about BDSM. And nothing could be further from the truth. A lot of bondage, discipline, and sadomasochism is actually very spiritual, very consensual, very negotiated, and an incredibly evolved art, if you will. It just happens to look like violence. And here, again, we get on this slippery slope. You know, what is violence? What is sex? I think sex is when two people, you know, choose to share pleasure and hopefully some intimacy and connection, but it doesn't have to be a long-term thing. It doesn't have to be come under that the heading of love. And there's a great book out there called Transcendent Sex, written by Dr. Jenny Wade. And she documented some incredibly sacred sexual experiences, transformative sexual experiences that people have had with absolutely no training in Tantra and, you know, no background in sacred sexuality. It was just a spontaneous occurrence. For some of these people, they were long-term love affairs, and for others, they were one-night stands.
Mm.
So we, you know, we have to be careful because we might say, oh, sacred sex would be, you know, doing conscious breathing or meditation or prayer, and it could be. It absolutely could be. But some people have had sacred sex experiences just picking somebody up in a bar and winding up in a motel room.
Well, you know, the major religions teach that the sacred is just always within reach. I mean, it's like you have to go through some big ritual to get there, usually.
Sometimes, you know, it's a spontaneous thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a very spontaneous thing. And I think a lot of it is just about being open. Being open to that. And I think the reason that we don't have more sacred sexual experiences is because so many of us are shut down emotionally. We are really endeavoring not to allow ourselves to have a spiritual connection or a sacred experience.
We're fleeing it?
Well, we're shutting it out with drugs and alcohol. We're shutting it out with antidepressants. We're shutting it out with television. We're shutting it out, you know, with anything we can to do to distract ourselves so that most of us, you know, only breathe like in the first one-third of our lungs. We're just kind of skating the surface of life and trying to avoid feelings. And, you know, by and large, most of that is because we've all got some kind of trauma we're trying not to be aware of.
Yeah.
So, and this is the price of admission. You want to have sacred sex, you've got to clear the trauma out. You actually have to be able to deal with, you know, your past and your demons, quote unquote. And if you can deal with those, then you create a clearing and a way for the sacred sexual experience to find you.
Ah, so. I mean, some of what you've said sounds like Tantra. In Tantra finds sacredness in being truly present to whatever's happening in the moment.
True. Yeah.
Open. So would you say that it's... You're probably going to say it's both, but...
Well, I would say Tantra...
Or is it the openness that's sacred, or...
Tantra is a tricky word. You know, there are so many people who want to own that word.
Well, of course.
So many people want to own the word Tantra. It's almost become another branch of Christianity.
What, yet another?
You know, because Christians is like, no, this is Christianity. No, this is Christianity. You know, there's too many people out there with Tantra that are doing the same thing. And I, you know, I think if you're jockeying for the final say on what is Tantra, you've kind of lost the whole idea of what is Tantra. Because Tantra was really supposed to be embracing, you know, the dark and the light, the so-called good and the evil, but life as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's conscious breathing, and there's sex, and there's a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with sex. But, you know, my experience with Tantra has been just about the sexual part of it. So, you know, like doing a fire breath orgasm with a teacher by the name of Jawala.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, transformative experience in my life. Doing some exercises, tantric exercises that the Association for Sexual Energy Professionals, when we had our first meeting in Arizona about 4 or 5 years ago. Amazing stuff. At One Taste in San Francisco, did a lot of tantric-like sex, but they didn't usually call it Tantra, but they certainly were doing a lot of the, you know, conscious breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they did at One Taste, which is very tantric, if you, you know, study history, is the whole idea of kind of foregoing the ejaculation or the orgasm.
Uh-huh.
And kind of staying in that state of arousal for an extended period of time. So there are techniques. You can call them Tantra if you want. You can call them sacred sex techniques. But there are some specific techniques that can certainly help you to achieve a sacred sexual experience. And, you know, one of those is conscious breathing. And conscious breathing combined with PC muscle exercises. So PC muscles being your pubococcygeal muscles. This is in the pelvic floor. It's the same muscle you use to stop and start a flow of urine.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, it's the same muscle that a dog wags its tail with.
Is that why they do that so much?
This is what I've tried to say is, you know, we as adult human beings are trying to learn stuff that we were born knowing how to do. Obviously, the dog didn't forget.
Yeah, they get into that.
And I have to tell you, one of the things I find fascinating about this whole thing, you know, where human beings get so caught up in their hierarchical thinking, which is a characteristic of the great apes. They, you know, like to think they've got a secret and they've got a special handshake and they got a special friend and nobody else knows about it. But the fact of the matter is that all of nature is doing Tantra. And if you happen to actually watch animals in the wild and in nature when they are having sex and they're mating and it just even going through their mating rituals, there's a lot of breathing, a lot of deep breathing, a lot of PC squeezing. You know, I mean, it's a really visceral, amazing, all-encompassing experience. And it's we that have kind of compartmentalized ourselves and cut our genitals off from our hearts and our hearts off from our heads, and then we're struggling to try to put all this stuff back together.
Right. Well, you know, there's a tremendous cultural thing going on. I mean, I'm sure my early training would object violently to this kind of, you know, sex as sacred. There's a whole undercurrent, I guess you'd call it, that the body is sort of beneath us. You know, the spirit is where you're supposed to be, and the body is a burden that we have to bear for, you know, the 70 or 80 years.
When I left escorting and I told my mom that I was now teaching sacred sex, she was horrified.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, but wait a minute, I'm no longer a sex worker. I thought you'd be thrilled. And she was horrified. She thought, you know, oh, my God, does this mean that you're having sex in the outdoors under the full moon or something?
Heaven forbid.
Does that come with animal sacrifices? I mean,
maybe a steak, I don't know.
Oh my God. I was like,
but where does this come from? I mean, it seems to be so pervasive in our culture, it must serve some purpose for us or something.
To be afraid of it?
Yeah, to have to denigrate the body so.
Well, this goes back thousands of years, but not so terribly far that we can't actually kind of chronicle it through history. So the first written word, the first story that was ever committed to writing was written down. I wouldn't hesitate to say that it was put on paper. I don't believe they had paper at that time. But the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Uh-huh.
It's the first time that a human being goes to write a story. And this is a very beautiful story about a man who is living in the forest, very much like an animal. He walks on all fours and he laps the water and he's copulating with the beast in the field. And this king finds him and decides that what he needs is to have sex with a courtesan, a sacred prostitute. And so for like a week, he's having sex with this sacred prostitute, and at the end of that time, he becomes a human being. He's been civilized.
Oh, uh-huh.
So the very earliest story that human beings told was how sex could civilize you.
Yes.
And that's where we started. That's where we started. And if you go to the temples in India, you know, all the doorways are adorned with all kinds of images of people having sex, all kinds of different sex.
Mm-hmm.
So we depart from that about the time that the peaceful agrarian goddess worshiping cultures are overtaken and massacred by the hunter-gatherers who have not invented mass and haven't written anything, and kind of take that over. They take it over by brute force.
Uh-huh.
And they bring in their sky god. You know, so at this point is a patriarchal, that's, you know, a male god who lives up in the sky. And he's very militant, he's very jealous, he's very angry. He's always sending down lightning bolts to destroy people. He demands, you know, that you sacrifice your children or at least an oxen or something. And when we get that, their patriarchy was totally built upon the premise that we need to know who the father is. The goddess cultures didn't care. The goddess cultures, you know, we're passing property from mother to daughter. So it was irrelevant who the father was, and therefore promiscuity really didn't have any charge. Nobody was worried about it.
Hmm.
But with patriarchy, promiscuity becomes a huge sin because we don't know who the dad is if we can't track it.
Right.
And so we lose that whole sensibility about sex being this beautiful doorway to the divine. We lose the idea that the sex could, you know, create fertility, that it would be a way to celebrate spring. That's all gone.
Hmm. So we lose our freedom, and sex becomes a commodity.
It becomes a commodity, and it becomes, and at this point now, women become, instead of women being spiritual leaders and sacred prostitutes and queens and even warriors, women become slaves.
Hmm.
And the woman's body becomes very suspect. So everything that the woman's body does is evil. And when she's menstruating, she has to be put without the camp because she'll pollute the Holy of Holies. She can't go into
right.
anything sacred or touch the food or touch the crops. So we go from the woman being the source of life to her somehow or another, even her menstrual blood, which is all about giving life, becomes a symbol for death and destruction and disease.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really perverse.
I remember seeing that in the Old Testament, thinking, what? Wait a minute,
yeah.
Where did this come from?
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, and so, by the time you get to the New Testament, you've got Paul saying that it's better to marry than to burn, but that he wishes you could all live like him.
Yeah, well, he should have taken his advice.
He wanted everybody to be celibate because he felt the celibacy was a higher ideal. And so, you know, from Paul, then we start going into basically, you know, early Christians start pushing away the body, pushing away the body, pushing away the body. And so then you wind up with Christians who, of course, self-flagellate, you know, and torture themselves. And, you know, we have since outgrown some of those more grotesque manifestations of faith. But that's the roots of the monotheistic religions, was, you know, not just about doing without sex, but literally about, you know, sleeping on a bed of nails and, you know, not eating decent food and just really trying to starve and deny the body in every possible way.
Yeah, and so you're saying this just grew, or, I mean, my original question was, does it serve some purpose that we're so committed to it?
I think at this point, one thing that comes to mind is a story about the fifth monkey. A friend of mine told me, maybe you've heard the story. Basically, they've got some monkeys in a, you know, confined area, and they put a banana up on, and it's just out of reach. All you have to do is climb the ladder and you can get the banana.
Mm-hmm.
But every time they go to climb the ladder, I think they get sprayed with water. So gradually the monkeys learned they probably don't want to do that. So by the time the fifth monkey arrives, he is told, don't go up the ladder, but he never knows why. Then it becomes a myth, you know, just basically a myth. And we have a lot of taboos that people do because that is the way it's always been, and therefore that's the way it should be.
Yeah, well, it's certainly taught, you know, parent to child to parent to child.
Right, and people lose, you know, like, and people come up with explanations. Like, for instance, while we're talking about how the body's been demonized, let's not leave out circumcision of males. This country, the United States, is still circumcising, and most countries in the world have stopped. And, you know, the rate has dropped way off. But the highest rate of circumcision seems to be here in the U.S., except for, I'm sure, Israel. But so we have two countries that are still lopping off the foreskins of all of their males. And the story has changed. If you go back historically, it is very clear that circumcision was invented to curb masturbation. But the story has gone from, you know, that to somehow or another it would eliminate cervical cancer in women.
Yeah, I heard that go by, and I thought, whoa, I'd like to see that study.
We've had a lot of stories and studies, so-called scientific studies, to try to support this basically senseless taboo.
Oh, no, don't say it, Veronica.
And it's very difficult to get human beings to be logical. It's very difficult to get humans to abandon custom. However, usually if there is some money in it, you can turn things around. So if at some point we found money in the whole idea of allowing people to have sexual freedom, I'm sure, you know, that we would. For instance, porn. They found ways to make money at porn, so, you know, it's legal.
Well, porn we got, that's for sure.
We do. But I think the other thread to this is about control. And I think that when, you know, in nature, when an animal reaches its adulthood, it becomes sexually viable. It's that these things travel together. So I think it's really interesting the ways in which we try to remove sexual independence from people. And if you look at our Constitution, it gives us the right to free assembly, free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. We have all of these rights, but we do not have any right to sexual, you know, unless you want to try to squeeze that under the right to pursue happiness. But there's nothing that specifically says you have a right to have a sex life.
Well,
and
you know,
consequently, the government has come and said, well, you can't have sex in this way. So we've had the sodomy laws. that said that you couldn't have oral sex, or that you couldn't have anal sex, or that you couldn't have homosexual sex, or that you couldn't have lesbian sex.
Or sex outside of marriage, for that matter. I mean,
that's right. The miscegenation laws, you know, where you couldn't marry somebody of a different race. Always, you know, the government has felt free to control our sex lives. Obviously, saying that you can't pay for sex, that you can't sell sex, unless, of course, there's a third party paying you to have sex and selling video of you having sex.
Because there's money in that.
You couldn't do the third party unless they had a camera rolling and they happened to have a huge label attached to it.
Oh, my God, you're right.
Yeah.
You had to have the third party with the camera.
If you're a third party without a camera, then you're a pimp.
Holy cow.
It makes no sense at all.
It's like tax law.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, but it does serve the idea of control. And the only corollaries that I can really find in nature, I always think back to I think about wolf packs. Now, wolves tend to have a dominant pair that do the breeding, and the other wolves in the pack do not breed. And what they do is they take care of the dominant pair's offspring. They babysit them like aunts and uncles.
They do the village thing.
They do. And what happens there, a lot of times with the wolves, is it's actually a hormonal thing, so that their testosterone and their hormones get suppressed. I don't know how effective this is. I don't know how universal it is. It's certainly something that's been documented in the literature. But, you know, I've had enough personal experiences of animals to know that a lot of what passes for science about animal behavior is, you know, sometimes just what that particular little group was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless of whether it's universal for all wolves, I do think it's an interesting idea that maybe even in nature sometimes there is a vested interest in suppressing procreation and sexual expression in some members, you know, to not allow them to have that.
Right.
Yeah. And it is exactly what we do to our pets. We neuter them.
We do.
We neuter our pets, and a lot of times we do this so that we will have more control over them. The story at this point is that we don't want to have an overpopulation. Well, that's kind of a modern problem of having too many. It's not, I don't believe, where that originated. I think a lot of it originated because, in particular, male dogs and cats have some really noxious behaviors when they have a full set of testicles.
Mm-hmm.
They might mark or spray or wander or just be incredibly, opinionated and forceful and difficult to handle.
None of this applies to humans, of course.
Well, don't you think? The idea that, if we want to keep human beings in line, you know, let's keep them fear-based around their sexuality because we don't want them to actually grow up.
Well, that fits.
I know when I was speaking at Yale University last year, I looked at all the students and I said, I'll bet you couldn't wait to leave home and thought that you were going to finally be able to be in charge of your own sex life. And all their little eyes lit up, and it was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I said, well, guess what? You're not in charge of your sex life. Uncle Sam is. I saw some shocked looks. I was like thinking about that for a minute. Really? Seriously? I thought I could do whatever I want. I go, no, you can't. You can't do whatever you want.
As long as you don't get caught, at least.
Yeah, but the government is in charge of your sex life. And it's a shocking thing when you actually think about it because the government cannot be in charge of how you worship. So you have freedom of religion, at least to some extent. Freedom of speech, so you start to think you're free in every way, but no, your sex life is not yours.
You know, that's really odd when you point it out.
It is, isn't it? It's so deeply personal.
Right.
It's so deeply personal. You would think that would be the first thing that you would get a right to control.
So that's the negative.
Yeah.
Can we go back, like, to the positive?
Positive, like, about what?
Sacred sex.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're asking me if there's something positive about controlling our sexuality, or then I'd have to say there isn't.
Right.
Not where I stand. I think, again, if we mislabel certain forms of violence as sex, and that is often, you know, the smokescreen that's put up. It's like, well, we have to control all this. It's like, no, that's violence. And yes, you should control violence.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as adult consensual behavior, it's really nobody's business. What kind of positives about sacred sex do you want to know?
Well, you said way back then that all sex is sacred, and that sort of doesn't leave me anywhere to go. I mean,
as far as how to bring sacred sex into a sacred sexual experience into your life.
Well, that, yeah, unpack that a little bit, would you, Flora?
Yeah, absolutely. It all starts with the breath. It really does. The breath is so important. What happens if you haven't been breathing, doing conscious breathing, is there is a certain amount of anxiety attached with it. And conscious breathing is, you know, to breathe in through your nose, deep down into your belly, so you let your belly get soft and you let it expand. And then you just kind of hold it for a little bit, you know, like maybe a couple of beats, and then you let it back out through your mouth. And this will bring up feelings if you have a backlog of suppressed feelings. And, you know, I've worked through a lot of my stuff. I don't like to think I have much of a backlog. But conscious breathing will sometimes bring up uncomfortable feelings for me that have just accumulated over the course of a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I really am convinced this is one of the reasons people take shallow breaths, because they're trying not to feel. But in the process of taking shallow breaths, you're not fully in your body. So conscious breathing brings you way back into your body, and it really allows all of that beautiful kundalini energy, which is the sexual energy. Many people believe the sexual energy is kind of coiled at the base of your spine, like a snake. You don't have to believe that, but sometimes it's helpful to picture that if you want to, if that works for you. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. But there is energy that in the lower chakras, and again, if you don't believe in chakras, that's okay. There is energy down in the genital area of your body. See, I just keep reducing this until we've got a common language here. So whether you believe it's kundalini energy or a chakra or just your genitals, there is energy in that part of the body which can be raised into the rest of your body. Mm-hmm. So for some people, they envision this as going through the various different chakras. I don't care if you call them chakras. I don't think the sacred sexual experience cares if you call them chakras. But if you breathe, and you breathe in a conscious way so that your breath is circulating first through your nose and then out through your mouth, in through your nose, out through your mouth, and you really are breathing way down into your belly. Now, we always say breathe into your belly, but you're really breathing into the bottom part of your lungs. And you want to loosen that belly, because a lot of us are running around with tight bellies, you know. So you loosen that and you let the breath go all the way down in, and then you let it come out. And sometimes it's helpful to count. Some people like to chant. Some people like to do this in front of a candle or underneath the stars, or, you know, while burning incense. You could play some nice music while you're doing this. It's really about what works for you. You could be sitting in the lotus position. You could be in a recliner. You could be laying down. Your lover could be massaging you. You find what works for you. But you do need to breathe, and you need to breathe in a way that's unfamiliar to you, because most people are breathing in a way that is about anxiety. They're tensing, they're holding it in. So that's the first step, is the breath. Now, if you want to add PC exercises to this, this gets the energy moving around, and it also gets the blood flowing down there. And down there is where we want it to get. We want it to get moving, and we want to get it moving into other parts of our body. So if you think about this energy as like something that you're stirring with a spoon, then exercising your PC muscles becomes one of the ways that we are stirring that energy up.
That's funny.
And you can do a fire breath orgasm exercise, which uses the conscious breathing and the PC muscles in a particular rhythm. Or you can find your own reality on that. But to engage both of those is to start raising this energy. And we are energies. And if you're doing this by yourself or you're doing this with another person, then you start raising this energy. And, the first thing that can actually happen is you might actually just feel a little lightheaded because you're not used to getting that much oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the first time I started doing this, I thought, well, that's all that's happening. I'm just getting lightheaded, and these people are hysterical idiots.
Oh, dear.
But, if you stick with it long enough, what happens is you start activating these energy centers in your body, and you start to be more alive, and you start to be more in tune, and you start to feel more connected. And then what might seem like an inconsequential thing, like a kiss, just a kiss, could like send your whole body vibrating into orgasmic revelry, just a kiss.
I've seen a little bit of that.
Yeah,
if you actually
I know.
Show up for something, it becomes a whole lot bigger.
Yeah. Yes. That's the whole point about sacred sex. It's not a magic potion or pill. It's not a machine. We don't just flip a switch, and we don't say a bunch of incantations. That would be sex magic.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing. But sacred sex is really about opening yourself up to the flow of energy. And
saying,
for some of us, that might be kind of scary. Huh? You might be afraid of some of the darker energy that's out there. And if that conforms to your belief system, then you might want to say some protective prayers or do some saging or cleansing of your space before you would invite this flow of energy. And for other people, that has no validity or reality for them, so don't worry. There is so much flexibility in how this would be achieved. Now, if anybody out there decides to read this book by Dr. Jenny Wade, Transcendent Sex, I highly recommend it. One of the reasons I love this book is because it is not pretentious, and it doesn't claim that there is one way to have a transcendent sexual experience. It just very simply documents other people's experiences. And it seems like the only really common thread running through all of this for all these people was that they had a spontaneous moment where they were able to let go for whatever reason. Now,
let go of?
To let go. To let go. Let go of is still hanging on.
Ricky Veronica.
Letting go of control.
And just letting be whatever happens.
Yeah. And that's a tough one. Most of us show up for sex with an agenda. We want to have an orgasm.
or this or that, yeah.
Yeah, so wanting to have an orgasm becomes an obstacle to a sacred sexual experience because you're not showing up for whatever's in front of you. Now you have an agenda. And if your agenda is that you're going to have an orgasm, most of us kind of figure we know how we're going to get there. So being able to let go is really the third piece of the sacred sexual encounter. You want to breathe. You want to squeeze your PC muscles. You know, for some people, that's just going to be because they're excited and you know, it's normal to squeeze it. For some of us, we're so dead down there, we got to learn how to squeeze them again. But, you know, again, I want to emphasize, your dog already knows how to do this stuff. This is not about becoming some spiritual master, and anybody who tries to tell you it is full of it. You know, this is really about returning to the original blueprint for sex, which is sacred. Now, I've heard some people tell me, oh, I've seen animals have sex. There's nothing sacred about it. And, you know, to almost every single one of those people, I say, you've never seen them do it in the wild. You've seen, really, agricultural rape, you know. I saw three bucks just rutting. There was no female in sight. And they were just alongside the road, and this was just like a month ago. And I had to stop and take a video of it. I was just fascinated. I actually loaded it to YouTube. And if anybody wants to check it out, it's not that fantastic. I was filming it on a silly little camera, not a really, you know. I wasn't trying to do a documentary here. I was just driving home, and I went, oh, my God, look at those deer. They look like they're having fun. But anyway, my YouTube channel is The Shame-Free Zone, just like the name of this show. So these three bucks, there was one, he was older, and the way I know he was older is because he had a huge spread. I don't know how many points it was, probably like a 12-point or something like that. He had a really big rack of horns. And then there were two bucks, I think they were just what you call 4 points. And they were younger. But the three of them were having just a really sensual, erotic experience, jousting for position. So, you know, they were breathing. Their PC muscles were very active. How do I know that? Because their penises were moving and their tails were moving and they were urinating all over the place and they were snorting and they were doing battle with the bushes and they were jousting each other very playfully and having a hell of a good time. And it really came across as kind of almost homoerotic. Like they were very sexually aroused while they were doing this and there was no female. And they weren't trying to mount each other, but they were showing up for this very ancient reenactment with everything, all their breathing and all their life force and all their chi was right there. And I thought to myself, all the dead human beings driving by.
Yeah, vroom, vroom.
Exactly.
Got to make it to San Francisco.
Yeah. So, you know, if you do get a chance to see animals doing what they do in the wild, you know, and you can just stop, turn everything off, turn off the BlackBerry, turn off the radio, breathe, and watch how the animals show up for life. They're really connected, you know. They're totally engaged.
Cool.
Does that help?
Well, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Cool. For anybody else, we have anybody that's listening right now, I just want to invite you once again. You can post to my Facebook wall if you like. It's veronica.monet, Or you can call us live. Our 800 number is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I know you had some other questions for me, Eric.
Well, I do. That one's kind of silly.
Oh, there's no silly questions.
Well, I grew up in a very Christian environment, and so, you know, I still come from that direction.
Right.
What does God think about this? You know.
Yeah.
And to me, I've been playing with the question of, is there sex in heaven? And I know you've had a lot of rooting background, call it, in Christianity as well. And I don't know. I just thought that was an intriguing question. Because, you know, when Jesus was resurrected and he appeared to the all those guys, the disciples, right?
Yes, the disciples, right.
You know, the gang.
The 12 apostles.
All those guys.
Yeah.
You know, like, he didn't do much of anything, but one of the things he made a point of doing was calling for food and wine and eating and drinking in front of all the folks.
Right.
Like, his body was still with him.
Right.
Still functional. So?
You know, theology, not my expertise.
Well, I know. That's why it's a silly question.
No, it's not a silly question, but I do believe that some Christians believe that there is no male or female in heaven. I think there's a verse that says something to that effect.
There is no marriage or giving in marriage.
Ah, okay. So it doesn't say that there's no male or female?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really need marriage to have sex even here.
Well, maybe not.
I've heard, at least.
I could tell you what my mother, who was a very devout Christian, told me.
Ah.
When I was like 8 years old, and I go, Mommy, what's an orgasm feel like? And she said, it's God's way of letting you know what is waiting for you in heaven.
Well, there you go.
I loved that.
Yeah.
That was very sex positive. And here's an interesting thing about, we're talking about raising this kundalini.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who believe that religious experience, the ecstatic religious experience, is actually very closely related to a tantric kundalini experience.
Well, I would agree.
Well, in particular, you know, some of the religions, such as the, I guess I'm not real familiar with the Quakers and the Shakers, but I guess they have some ecstatic states, and the definitely the Holy Rollers, who that's what my grandmother, one grandmother was a Mormon, the other one was Assembly of God.
Oh, right then.
the Pentecostal, you know, religions believe in speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
And they reach a place where they become very, very overcome with religious fervor and ecstatic ecstasy, and oftentimes fall down in the aisles and you know, shake and speak in tongues. So I personally think that, you know, that probably is actually a sexual experience, a sacred sexual experience. But, of course, I'm sure that those particular people would be horrified, and I'm sure my grandmother's probably rolling over in a grave right now.
Well, because they insist on the separation. No, that's your spirit, not your body.
Right. And again, once you really start engaging in the sacred sexual energy, you start to realize that there isn't a separation between sex and spirit. They are connected inextricably.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, even in the Christian paradigm, we were originally created whole. I mean, we weren't limping along with our body trailing after or something. We were created whole.
Certainly, I think that the story of Jesus gives us a lot of models for a sex-positive religion, because, you know, you know, if you believe some people's interpretation, his best friend was a prostitute. When the prostitute went to anoint his feet and with the sacred oil, and she was using her hair to wipe the oil from his feet, there were some who were horrified because of her station in life, and he corrected them and was very accepting of her gesture.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then of course there's some people that think that Jesus actually married Mary Magdalene and that they had a baby. And there's some people that think that that's horrible and outrageous to suggest such a thing.
But it certainly didn't make the accepted headlines.
No, but it's certainly, a historical reference for some people. Some
uh-huh.
people would consider that there's quite a bit of validity to that.
Mm.
I think what's interesting is how we have gradually moved away from our gods and goddesses having sex. But if you go back to the ancient Greeks, that's all they did.
Oh, the Greek gods and goddesses, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they were just having sex all the time.
Sex in the mountains, sex in the trees, that's right.
Yeah. Of course, their gods and goddesses were very human and had a lot of human foibles, too.
Well, they had more than one, and maybe that helps. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the universe has a very strong sexual message for us. I really do. I think that the universe is trying to tell us that sex is, at our core, and that it's much bigger than something about procreation, that it's much bigger than orgasms, that it's much bigger than romantic love, that it's really about connecting us to the divine, which is what the ancients really believed, that was a doorway.
A doorway.
A doorway
like
to
thought.
The divine.
Yes, if you can get there with bread and wine.
You'd think you could get there with an orgasm. Or the absence of an orgasm. Well, I think it's about time I wrap this show up, Eric.
Right then.
Looking at the clock here. So I'm really glad you asked all these questions. They were awesome questions.
Thank you. Well, thank you for filling all this in for me.
Well, should I give you a send you away with an exercise?
Yeah, excellent. Yes, you should do that.
Okay. So, I don't know have I given you the fire breath orgasm exercise?
You've hinted and but no, you haven't.
Okay. All right. So, this is how you do a fire breath orgasm. And I should just warn you that if you were in a room full of other people who were ecstatic, mm-hmm. it'd probably take 20 minutes to get there. If you're doing this all by yourself, there's not as much energy to access. So I think you should allow at least an hour. But the thing is, you have to show up without expectations, so it might take a lot of tries to get there. But you lie on your back with your knees bent up and your feet flat on the floor or bed, wherever you're laying down.
Mm.
And then you start breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. In through your nose and out through your mouth. And you want to get into a nice rhythm with that first. And then at some point, you start working the contraction of the PC muscles. So you would contract your PC muscles when you breathe out and relax your PC muscles when you breathe in. And then we're going to add a third element to this. So once you've got the breathing and the PC contractions coordinated with each other, so you're breathing in and you're relaxing. You're breathing out and you're contracting. Then we're going to add a tilt of the pelvis muscles so that the whole pelvis is going to tip up and down, up and down, up and down. And when you tip up is when you are taking a breath in and relaxing your PC muscles. So basically you're up and open. And then as you tip down and your buttocks touches the bed or the floor, that's when you squeeze your PC muscles and you breathe out. And that's the exercise. I did that for about 20 minutes in a room full of probably 30 women, and I thought it was nonsense, and I was getting ready to leave, and all of a sudden a bolt of fire shot up the base of my spine and out the top of my head.
Oh, woohoo!
And that was my first fire breath orgasm, and it was very scary because I got to tell you that I'd never had an orgasm that was completely disassociated from my genitals. It had nothing to do with my genitals.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'll leave you with that.
Huh.
That's it. Go have fun.
Okay.
Go make love to the universe.
Cool. Thank you, Veronica.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate it. And we'll be back here next Monday, same time, same channel. I will have a surprise guest at that time. Not going to tell you who or what yet. I'll post it on Facebook. Anyway, that's it from the Shame-Free Zone. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.